Away from the Great American Horse Race on Super Tuesday. I'll try to make my thoughts, I hope there have some thoughts that'll be valuable to you. This talk I came together rather later than I wanted it to, and as a result, I realized a bit too late that it's a little busier than I like it usually to be. So I apologize ahead of time if I'm overwhelming you with information. If even one little piece of an idea is valuable and something that you can take home with you, then I'll be glad of that. So we've been looking at mindfulness of the body, the first foundation of mindfulness, or as some people phrase it, the first way that we can set up awareness, mindful awareness of the body, the first establishing of mindfulness, as it's sometimes called, to sort of put the emphasis on the qualities that we have in mind, that the qualities of mind that we establish when we look at the body or feelings or the other foundations of mindfulness. That's really the first thing that we should pay attention to. What are the qualities of our mind when we're investigating these aspects of our experience? So a way to sort of keep that in mind is instead of using the usual translation, the first foundation of mindfulness, using the first establishment of mindfulness, or the first way of establishing mindfulness. So I wanted to first just briefly review the six practices that are included in mindfulness of the body. We looked at breathing. We're told in the instructions on mindfulness of breathing that we should be mindful as we breathe in and mindful as we breathe out. When breathing in long, we should know that we're breathing in long. When breathing in short, we should know that we're breathing in short. And like so many of the instructions that are included in this sutta and many other suttas, We should look at them in the context of the whole set of teachings. And when we do that, we realize that often these instructions are more representative than comprehensive. So if there's another aspect of the breath that we find more engaging than whether it's in or out or long or short, by all means, focus your mindful awareness on that. And use that to calm and concentrate the mind. At one retreat that I attended, Santi Caro, a Western Buddhist, former Western Buddhist monk, gave me a wonderful tip for how to get more engaged with the breath, and that was to pay attention to whether the in-breath comes naturally or whether I'm sort of willing it to happen. In other words, am I surrendering control of the breath to the body, or am I controlling the breath, even subtly? And paying attention to the end of the out-breath and the beginning of the in-breath, and really fully relaxing and surrendering control of the breath to the body, so that the in-breath occurs when the body's ready and not when I'm ready, that made all the difference, and really took my mindfulness of breathing practice from being something that I kind of grinned and bore and just kind of didn't find very satisfying, to one that just I truly looked forward to doing every day. So anything you would find, any aspect of the breath you find engaging, you know, by all means, use that as the focus of your awareness. And then we are also then instructed to become conscious of the effect that the breath is having on our body. Especially, how can we breathe in a way that calms the body? And then try to allow the body to breathe in that way, so that calm arises. It's a rather long, brief summary of mindfulness of breathing. Postures, we're instructed to know that we are walking when we're walking, know that we are standing when we're standing. The same with sitting and lying down. And again, this was not meant to be comprehensive. Whatever posture or position the body is found in, know that you are in that position or posture. Then we looked at mindfulness of bodily activities, which kind of takes postures one or two steps further and says, be mindful and clearly knowing of any movement of the body, you know, the subtle movements of fingers, the movement when we eat, be clearly comprehending of when you are talking, when you are listening, when you are lying down, all the activities that we engage in. We are to acquire the mental habit of always knowing what we're doing and why. So for instance, when we're eating, we pay attention to the act of eating itself rather than getting lost in thought. We make certain that this act of eating reflects our deepest values and intentions. For instance, are we eating just enough to sustain the body, or are we eating primarily to delight in pleasurable tastes? There's no judgment there. There's no should there. It's just be aware of that, and be aware of whether whatever action you're engaged in is in line with what you want. In terms of intentions, how you wish to live your life. If you're living your life through a Buddhist lens, you know, are these activities in line with the rest of the path? So, again, acquiring the mental habit of always knowing what you are doing, when you're doing it, and why. The next practice was anatomical parts, taking apart the body in your mind and looking at head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, you know, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, all the internal organs, feces and the contents of the stomach and blood and all the bodily fluids, really just taking our bodies apart and seeing them for what they actually are. And again, this the list of 31 or sometimes 32 parts of the body that is included in this sutta and others not intended to be comprehensive. If there's another part of the body that you find particularly useful for some reason, feel free to use that. I personally find the eyeball very useful because when I look in the mirror at my own eyes, they seem so alive. It's said to be, they're said to be the mirrors of the soul. But when I mentally pluck my eyeballs from their sockets, set them on a table, and see them for what they really are, that illusion vanishes. They become just another organ or mass of cytoplasm. Not particularly attractive, not particularly unattractive. Still blue. The next way that we can establish mindfulness of the body is by looking, again, taking a step further, the parts of the body contemplation, and looking at the body as a collection of physical elements. Physical elements that we have in common with all inanimate objects. And there's something called the refrain in the Satipatthana Sutta, that this discourse on the four establishments of mindfulness. There's something called the refrain in this because it follows each of these exercises, just like the refrain of a song follows each verse. And in this refrain, they talk about doing these contemplations both internally and externally, or both internally and externally. And what is meant by that can be seen very clearly in this contemplation of physical elements, in that we're encouraged to look at our own bodies as the earth element, the water element, the air element, and the fire element, or if you prefer, solid, liquid, gas, and energy. And then look at the external world around us. Same four physical elements. Everything's composed of them. And go back and forth and until it becomes very clear that we are in no meaningful sense any different than the world around us. As one teacher of mine put it, we should do this exercise until we see our bodies as a seamless extension of the physical world around us. And then the final contemplation that we've looked at, that has been mentioned, but we didn't actually look at it, was the cemetery contemplations, charnel ground, or the corpse in decay contemplations, where we visualize a corpse in some state or successive states of decay, depending on how you want to do it. Bloated and oozing fluids, eaten by carrion and worms, bones connected with sinew, bones scattered about so that the sense of there being a human skeleton doesn't even exist, bones that disintegrate, that have disintegrated into dust, merged with the earth that they came from. We do this to contemplate the ultimate fate of these body parts, these fluids and these physical elements that compose this body, decay and dissolution, a fact of life. So that's the what and the how of these mindfulness of the body contemplations. All in all, some rather unusual ways to spend one's time. Which begs the question, why? Why do we do this? What can we hope to gain? And why this, rather than spend our precious limited time on this earth enjoying the thousands of delights and distractions of the 21st century world. My wife is enjoying one of the distractions of the 21st century world at this moment. It's totally fine. It just seemed a wonderful way to illustrate. So why? You know, why do we do this? What's the point? What can we hope to gain? Very important question. And the kind of question that the Buddha always encouraged us to ask. So I think if we asked the Buddha that, I can be pretty certain that he would urge us to reflect on the status quo, which is the pervasiveness of discontent and dis-ease in our lives, despite these many delights and distractions that are available to us. If we have been sort of putting all our eggs in the delights and distractions basket, he might ask us, so how's that going for you? Specifically with regard to the body, he would have us reflect on the pain, the discomfort, the innate insecurity from having a body subject to aging, sickness, and death. It's just part of the package. And he would have us consider that we suffer due to these changes because we cling to and so completely identify with this body. So aging, sickness, and death are not just things that are happening, but they are things that are happening to me. And that's where the suffering comes from. Then he'd assure us that this state of affairs doesn't have to be. This all sound familiar? Four noble truths. He'd assure us that this state of affairs doesn't have to be. Certainly we cannot stop aging, sickness, and death. Nature will take its course. But we can find security and contentment and peace amidst these changes. If, and here's the crux of it all, if we can learn to let go of our attachment to this body, if we can stop personalizing what our natural process is. Just the universe going about its business. So how do we get there? How do we learn to let go and stop clinging to this body? By using this odd set of practices, of course. Using these practices, these six ways to attend to the body with mindfulness and clear knowing and calm equanimity. Using these practices to dig beneath the surface and see the body as it really is. Not as a stable, immortal, unitary whole, but as a collection of physical elements, cells, organs, always changing, subject to eventual and complete dissolution. These are all the insights that come from these practices. We dig beneath the surface and see the body as it really is, not as separate or different in any meaningful way from the rest of the physical world, but that seamless extension of the world. Just solid, liquid, gaseous matter, empty space in between, pulsing with chemical and electrical energy in flux. This is my particular favorite, and maybe the one that allows me to really get it sometimes. we dig beneath the surface and see the body as it really is, in that it's not something that we own and control, but it's empty. It belongs to nature. It goes about its business according to physical laws of the universe, without any enduring underlying ego or self orchestrating its actions. For me, for some reason, that aspect of control and lack of ownership just kind of resonates when I do some of these contemplations. Let me give you just one example, one or two examples of that. When I do take Santikaro's advice and surrender control of the breath to the body, when that shift occurs, when the body really does start breathing for itself, as it of course does when we're thinking of something else or when we're asleep, body's perfectly capable of breathing on its own. And we can make that shift when we're still awake and conscious and actually paying attention to the breath. And when that shift occurs, it is unmistakable. And you suddenly are just sort of like body surfing on the breath and just observing the breath as it happens without any sort of control or will involved. And then I find it just very natural and easy to establish that sort of deep meditative calm. And I sit and I observe. I'm no longer a doer, I'm just an observer. And I watch as the body sort of just undergoes these various changes. When bliss starts arising and tranquility settles in, and the mind shifts and suddenly distractions are just filtered out. And all of this happens without my willing anything. It's just the body going about its business, and I'm not in control. Another example is when I do the contemplations on physical activities, and just sort of get some momentum of mindfulness going and pay attention, for instance, to my hand and arm brushing my teeth for me, or tying my shoelaces. And I really pay attention to what's going on there, and I realize the incredible intricacy of what's happening there. And I'm not willing all of those fine, those thousands of fine movements. It's all happening habitually. It's that, you know, part of the brain that's, you know, it's on autopilot, and it's happening without me. And everything's happening without us. Just sometimes we think we're in control, but the body and the mind are perfectly capable of going about their business without us. We kind of see this, you know, in a shocking way when we've been on the highway for, or even in the city for 10, 15 minutes, and suddenly we realize we haven't really been paying attention, and all of this stuff has been happening without our willing it. So that's why that aspect of control and ownership I find really fascinating. So you know, in short, we dig beneath the surface using these contemplations and see the body as it really is, which, using the classical formula, is impermanent, subject to suffering, and egoless. So to directly know and see the body in this way, as it really is, this is the why of these practices. This is at least the highest purpose of these six practices for mindfulness of the body. And again, we are instructed to conduct these practices with a particular set of mental qualities established, well established: ardency, sometimes called diligence, devoted, continuous effort. Mindfulness and clear knowing and calm equanimity that comes from what's called samadhi, concentration, undistracted mind. So we're to set up this set of mental qualities, which includes mindfulness, but as a whole is perhaps more accurately known as right mindfulness. And with the mind established in this way, these six practices are beautiful and potentially very interesting ways of investigating the body, penetrating beneath the surface, beyond our comfortable preconceptions, to the actual truth of who and what we are. And this then, in the end, this then allows us to let go of attachment to this physical body. And not in the end, because, as I'll talk about a little later, this detachment from the physical body occurs little by little. And with each incremental detachment from the body, less clinging, comes peace. Ajahn Chah is well known for having said, let go a little and you'll have a little peace. Let go a lot and you'll have a lot of peace. Let go completely and you'll have complete peace. So this is the highest purpose of this these practices. This is the ultimate goal. And of course, as we all know, to get to that eventual place that, you know, we all dream of, takes a great deal of time and effort. So the question then becomes, how can those of us still on the path, perhaps quite far from the eventual goal, stay motivated? How can we stay the course? And one way to do this is to remind ourselves again and again of what the purpose of these practices are and the importance of these practices, what the potential fruits are. Kind of dangle that carrot in front of ourselves every now and then, perhaps at the beginning of every sitting. Just remind yourself, you know, why am I doing this? Have that clear intention that Mary talked about. And at the same time, remind yourself of the dangers of neglecting the practice. All of the unskillful thoughts, words, and deeds that might result from too much attachment to the body, and all the other dangers of an untrained mind for ourselves and for those around us. One truly excellent way to, and I think quite familiar way for most if not all of you, way to remind ourselves of the dangers of neglecting the practice is the five daily recollections. And these, I think, are particularly relevant to mindfulness of the body and the dangers of neglecting that practice and the resulting clinging and attachment to the body that will remain with us. These five daily recollections, especially appropriate in this context because they're a very powerful statement of the suffering that comes from clinging tightly to the body. Just to refresh your memory, they go as follows. And the Buddha encouraged us to recall these truths every day. I am of the nature to grow old. I cannot avoid aging. I am of the nature to become ill. I cannot avoid illness. I am of the nature to die. I cannot avoid death. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. So those are the facts of life, what is surely to happen. And again, the Buddha encouraged us to remind ourselves of that every day. But he didn't stop there. He also told us to remind ourselves of the power of the practice, the power of skillful action, such as meditation, keeping the precepts, all the other aspects of the path, including mindfulness of the body. And he told us to remind ourselves of the power of these skillful actions to shape future happiness and to prevent the suffering that otherwise would naturally accompany aging, sickness and death, and loss. And he talked about this in the context of karma, but we can replace the word karma with action, and it will have the same meaning. So he says, we should remind ourselves that I am the owner of my actions. I am born of my actions. I live supported by my actions. I am related to my actions. Whatever I do, whether good or evil, that I will inherit. I will inherit the results of those skillful or unskillful actions. So even though these facts of life are staring us in the face, we don't necessarily have to suffer as a result of them. And whether we will or not depends on whether we accumulate those skillful actions through the practice. So, reminding ourselves of the dangers of neglecting the practice, in this case, mindfulness of the body, these contemplations, reminding ourselves of the purpose and potential fruits of the practice. These should help to motivate us to stick with it. But again, as Ajahn Chah said, even letting go a little bit will bring a little peace. And so we don't have to wait for the end to taste the fruits of these practices. We can be tasting and savoring the fruits of these practices all along the way. Another well-known verse from the suttas is that the Dhamma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And this is just another way of saying that there are delights and joys as a result of this practice all along the path. And we should make sure that we recognize these fruits as they come to us and really savor them for the wholesome joy that they represent. And then, in addition to that highest purpose, you know, letting go of all clinging to this body, so that we can enjoy that lasting, reliable peace that comes from that realization that we are not our body. In addition to that highest purpose, there are other benefits and delights of these various contemplations on the body. I just wanted to share a few of those to entice you to try perhaps one of these practices that you haven't tried before, or engage in the practice and do so more consciously, aware of the fact that this is one of the reasons that this practice is important. This is one of the benefits that of this practice, one of the fruits. So with regard to the breath, clearly the breath is capable of bringing us peace and bliss here and now. These deep meditative states that come from mindfulness of breathing are available to us, you know, in the moment. And in fact, in addition to being the basis of the Buddha's awakening, they were also his favorite retreat from the world. Apparently 3 times a day, he would retreat to a secluded place and he would practice mindfulness of breathing and enjoy the bliss of deep meditative absorption. With regard to mindfulness of postures and activities, these are one of the most important benefits is that these support our practice of moral discipline, right speech, right action, keeping the precepts, because this habit of always knowing what we are doing and why allows us to make better choices rather than just habitual choices. And also results in more harmonious relationships, peace of mind that comes from living a morally upright life, self-esteem. These are all wonderful fruits of being more consciously aware of what you are doing in the moment. And as Mary mentioned in her talk last week, mindfulness of bodily activities is also a wonderful support for what's called sense restraint. The particular simile that I like best is of the 6 senses, the 6th one being the mind, as wild animals, all tethered to a strong stake that's grounded in the earth. And mindfulness of the body is that stake. It keeps the 6 senses from going out and feeding on the world and being triggered into craving or triggered into aversion by all of the sense impressions that are impinging on the mind. And because of that, when we're able to remain grounded in the body and fully aware of our actions, we're able to maintain a peaceful, composed mind in the midst of ordinary life. Regarding the benefits, the potential fruits of the contemplations on the parts of the body, the 4 physical elements, and the cemetery contemplations. This set of contemplations are called painful practice, I think in the commentaries. And they're recommended for people who have an especially passionate nature, who maybe appreciate too much the sensual delights of the world, because they allow us to bring such an unruly mind under control, in that they reduce our attachment to sensual pleasures. We see sensual pleasures for what they really are. If we are feeling passion and lust for a particular human being, we can ask ourselves, what part of their body do I desire? And put all the 31 parts on a table and look at them and take your pick. Or if we're feeling a desire to possess a particular object, a vase, a painting, whatever, and for some reason we feel that it wouldn't be wise to make that purchase, we might deconstruct that object in terms of the 4 physical elements and ask ourselves, which of these elements do I wish to possess? What element do we find so alluring? These are sort of classic antidotes to passion and lust. It also brings an unruly mind under control in the sense that it reduces pride and conceit. Again, if we see our own body as a collection of oddly shaped parts, not particularly beautiful as individual parts, or as just a collection of physical elements destined to decay like all things, our pride and conceit and arrogance just naturally vanishes. So these are all benefits of these practices, and one might seem particularly relevant to your situation at this time. Whatever we're dealing with, whatever challenges we're dealing with, pick that practice that seems most relevant at the time, or choose a practice that just you feel you can really sink your teeth into. What seems most engaging at this time? Another important point to keep in mind is that we're not meant to be doing all of these practices at the same time. We can just focus on one, and see what results from that, and move on to the next if it doesn't seem to be working. One other potential motivation that I find personally to be important is just the joy of discovery that comes from these practices. The deconstructing of my body into various parts and fluids and tissues. When I do that, and again, I use that perception of control and ownership. I find it endlessly fascinating. Even if that perception of the body as not mine, not myself, doesn't stick, in the moment, it can be fascinating, and fascinating enough to encourage me to do it again and again and again, and hopefully, over time, that perception will become more and more of the default perception. So if we can sort of keep that curious mind, that truth seeker mind, if you're someone for whom the unexamined life is not worth living, if you want to sort of slip out of the matrix and see reality at least once before passing from this world, that sense of keen curiosity can be a real powerful way to motivate continued practice. So, in summary, these six contemplations of the body, as with all of the practices on the Buddhist path, require time and effort. And so keeping ourselves motivated is itself a key aspect of the practice. And we need to be so we need to be clear about not just the what and the how of these practices, but also the why. We need to regularly reflect on the purpose and the benefits. And we need to be more consciously aware and recognize the moments of peace that they bring, or whatever fruits they bring us. We need to be aware of those, just as we need to be aware of joy in the mind whenever it arises, and encourage that to continue. We shouldn't just be aware of anger and lust and worry and all the negative states, but we need to be aware of the positive stuff as well on the path. That's equally important. And in this case, again, consciously aware and ready to recognize a fruit of whatever practice it is that you're engaged in, and let that motivate you to continue. Acquire a taste for any and all wholesome delights along the path. And as the Buddha suggested, regularly reflect on the suffering that occurs when we cling to the body, especially using the 5 daily recollections, but also the promise of peace that comes from letting go of that attachment to the body. The peace that comes from letting go a little, a lot, or completely. Because the Dhamma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. So we have a little time for our usual discussion. What I'd like to do is just, you know, do our usual sort of breaking up into groups of 3, and just give you a simple question to talk amongst yourselves about. And let's just do free form today. Being careful to allow everyone in the group to have their time to share. If you could just discuss what fuels the practice for you. What do you find most motivating? What keeps you coming to the cushion if you have a regular meditation practice? What keeps you, you know, on top of the precepts? What keeps you with that continuity of mindfulness if that's your practice? Whatever your practice is, what keeps you sustained? What fuels your motivation? If you have nothing to say about that, one other suggestion, given what you've heard today, what, if anything, seemed to resonate as particularly motivating or useful? What might you be able to use to motivate your practice in the future? Okay, so break up into groups of 3 and talk away. That free form, was everyone able to stay on topic?
Pretty much.
Everyone get a chance to share? Okay, how about, did anyone hear any particular way to stay motivated, to fan the fires of our practice that really struck you as being useful? Sure, it was all useful, but anything that just really struck you as, yeah, I'm going to try that.
When I'm holding Steve, giving him a big hug, I'm going to think, you're a lung. And it's going to just decay.
I wouldn't say it was a specific practice, but it was really motivating to hear that how practice is motivating for other people. I mean, because it sort of means that it's you hear how people make it part of their life, you know, and it's kind of invisible, but it's like, you know, I would look now and I would go, yeah, we had that discussion, and just looking at these guys, I just feel motivated. So that was nice.
Would anyone feel comfortable sort of quickly mentioning, you know, what you find most motivating, what really keeps you sticking with it?
Well, for me, it's the momentum of benefits. That, like you say, that a little bit leads to feeling, okay, this, it builds confidence, it builds, I'm gonna keep doing it because I'm seeing benefits, and then it keeps getting more and more. Then one thing that we talked about was, it seemed like everybody had a little flavor of making life a little lighter. The idea that we're not personally, it's not, Mary talked about some automatic lights going off and realizing that it's not a personal thing that the lights go off.
It was very annoying for a while.
Yeah.
And then I caught myself swearing at the lights, and that made me laugh because I realized that was kind of a ridiculous response.
It's all about me.
Yeah, so I think it's not only sort of an aha moment, but it's actually entertaining when you actually notice what your mind is doing in its response, because you're like, that is pretty funny. That is a ridiculous response to the lights going off. Yeah. And then the whole situation is a lot lighter. Yeah, not really
lighter.
Right.
Yeah, John, Jeff actually suggests using humor to keep us motivated.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Curiosity. You know, I'm right now doing a lot of experiments. So let's say there's something that I don't react to very well. So I will try doing practice and then I'll test it. No, okay, try something else. And try it again. Well, it's lots better. And then I try it the next day. Oh, not so good. Try something else. So it's, I guess I'm curious. I like experiments. And so testing, see if it works, try it again.
Yeah.
Try something else. Just tweaking and fiddling and
trial and error.
Entertaining.
I definitely have way less guilt and remorse, moment to moment. So it's just way easier to function.
And that, you know, that lightness, that lack of guilt or less guilt and remorse, you know, even if those are happening to us, they're not going to motivate us unless we're aware of them and conscious of them and remind ourselves that, oh yeah, this is happening. That's great. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Letting go of all the constructs in our life, everything we've created, and all our assumptions and judgments and feelings about who we think we are, and how much lighter you feel, like the body parts, just letting it all go. I really, really enjoyed your talk tonight.
Well, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.